Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, June 23rd, 2003, and we are in work session on House Bill 5016, which is the state school fund bill in the Department of Education. And when we left on Thursday, we asked LFO staff to run some funding scenarios for us based on the assumptions that we made in the committee, and we have those ready to talk about today. Chair would also like to welcome Representative Gilman again, and please feel free to ask questions and take part in the discussions. And with that, Ms. McGlashan, can you take us through what you've busily been doing while we haven't been here?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, you have before you a packet of information behind your agenda. The first piece of information is a single sheet of paper. Do you have this representative? I can.
This one?
The first sheet of paper is just a summary of the scenarios that we'll be going through today. And then behind the first single sheet of paper, you have several printouts of the quality ed model based on the various.
I have two copies of this, so this I think is from the.
Yeah, probably not too different.
Representative Gilman, I have an extra copy here that I'd be glad to give you.
So, Madam Chair, if and members of the subcommittee, if you'll direct your attention to that first summary sheet with the assumptions and then the various funding levels. I'll just walk you through that and then refer you to the relevant handouts behind that sheet. So you had asked to have all the scenarios based on an 11.11% PERS rate, and that was based on a discussion of a recommended school district rate for 0305 from the actuaries for PERS and in a letter dated June 19, 2003 to the PERS agency. And that is a recommended rate, and I understand that's going to be recommended to the board on June 30th. So all the scenarios in front of you have that rate incorporated into them. The next line is for the increase in health benefits costs, and you determined that you would assume a 9% increase in the growth in the cost of health benefits based on input from OSBA last week, and also assuming the same rate of growth that the PEB board is experiencing, and that's again 9%. The next item down, we didn't really talk about last week, and the assumptions are the same in the quality ed model throughout both the original and then all these revised versions, and that's in student growth. And those are annual rates, and the assumed rates of growth in students are 1.37% for the first year of the 0305 biennium, so that's for 2003-2004. And then 1.19% for the second year, 2004-2005. So again, those haven't changed even from the original model.
So, Ms. McGlashan, then in all three of the scenarios that you ran, the assumptions for the PERS rate, the increase in health benefits and student growth was the same across all of them?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And then the changes start on that next line for COLAs and STEPs. And in the first scenario, they're assumed to be not funded. And if you look at the first quality education model impact analysis behind this cover sheet, it's a two-page document. You'll see on the front, it says policy up in the upper left-hand corner. It says policy scenario zero salary growth. And then if you look in the column entitled policy scenario and follow that down to the bottom, you'll see a funding level of $4.8 billion. And that's assuming no COLAs, no STEPs, and also no inflation built into the policy scenario. If you turn to the page behind the impact analysis form, you'll see in the growth rates, that first section on that page, for teacher salaries, it does have some negative numbers in there, a minus 3.9% for 03-04 and a minus 1.3% for 04-05. Those numbers represent the teacher turnover and the retirement savings as a result. But again, there are no COLAs and no steps built into those factors.
So there's no salary decreases. There's only a factor because you have high-paying teachers retiring and lower-paid teachers taking their place.
That's correct. Thank you. And then...
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Do you have any idea what that looks like as far as the districts and schools are concerned, as far as loss of experienced teachers? I mean, the new ones coming in, are the ones being retained, are they right out of school, or?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I could answer that. There may be somebody in the audience who's...
Mr. Reeder, do you want to come forward and talk to us about the assumptions that were put into those numbers concerning the turnover rates?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. The average salary forecast that the department uses for a variety of things, but also as inputs to the quality education model, are based on a separate model that we call the salary forecasting model. And it breaks, essentially it takes a history of salary change and relates it to those factors that we believe impact teacher salaries. And the way we do that is we try to forecast the total number of teachers statewide as a function of the funding level and the number of students in Oregon. And then we break those into their components, which would be COLAs, step increases, and then we treat the turnover factor as the residual in that process, so that if, for example, there is a 2% overall increase in the average salary and COLAs equal 2% and turnover equals, or I'm sorry, step increases equal 2.5%, then you would have a 4.5% increase due to COLAs and steps, and that would imply a negative 2.5% savings from turnover. So the assumption there is that we observe the trend in average salaries and then back out anything related to the historical COLA and step increases, and then the difference that we observe there would be attributable to turnover. Now, typically, if you look at individual teacher information, which we have at the department, number of new teachers coming on with 0 years of experience, and the number of teachers leaving teaching, typically due to retirements, but also due to teachers leaving teaching. Typically, the ones leaving are retiring. The bulk of them are leaving because they're retiring. And most of the new teachers are coming in with zero experience. So, yes, they are brand new teachers right out of school.
Mr. Reeder, there is an issue with No Child Left Behind and teachers needing to be certified as highly qualified teachers in their subject areas. Can you talk to us about how that all factors into this?
Chair Morgan, I don't know the details of the highly qualified teacher requirements in No Child Left Behind. My understanding is that they involve both education and post-graduation, on-the-job professional development. But beyond that, I don't know all the details of how No Child Left Behind affects that. Typically, Oregon's teachers come out of school with master's degrees at a much higher percentage than most other states. And I think that probably gives Oregon an advantage in meeting the requirements of No Child Left Behind, because most of our teachers have that degree coming out of school.
Representative Bates, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair. I guess I'm asking a question that's really rather difficult to answer, and if not impossible to. I'm just going to get an overall picture. We're having a significant change in our teacher population this year, and probably next year, with a unexpectedly large number of retirements. I just wonder what that's doing to the workforce statewide. I know you can't give it district by district or site by site. But I want to get some sense. Are we losing a lot of our best teachers in the early 50s or late 50s? Age-wise, our most experienced and best teachers, is there any significant impact you expect from schools as a result of this? Were we previously heavy in the upper age group, and this is leveling us out? I mean, these things are usually a bell-shaped curve that moves along pretty steadily. I wonder if you have any sense of a significant change occurring because of the financial climate right now.
Now, Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, we do have some information regarding that. Oregon has a bubble right now of older teachers that are, and this bubble has been, you know, sort of moving up the age distribution, and we have for the past probably 3 or 4 years, this bubble has been right around the retirement age. So that's one of the reasons we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years higher retirements than usual, simply because there are more teachers in those age groups that are retiring. They're in their early to mid 50s, and that means if they started teaching right out of college or right out of graduate school, that they have close to 30 years experience. So what we've seen is typically back in the mid-90s, we had between 1,500 and 1,800 retirements each year of teachers in Oregon. In the last few years, that has crept up to around 2,000 or a little above that. And we anticipate at the end of this year, 02-03 school year, roughly 4,500 retirements. So we have this huge increase this year, which I think really is attributable to the PERS situation.
How many total teachers are there?
We have around 28,000 FTE in Oregon's K-12 schools. Since most teachers teach full-time, but not all of them, that's probably close to 29 or 30,000 actual teachers, but around 28,000 FTE.
15%.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I also wanted to ask a couple of questions in this area of No Child Left Behind requirements to have highly qualified teachers. And I believe that Mr. Sager may be able to help with the responses if he would come up. How should we look at these No Child Left Behind requirements to have highly qualified teachers and the model growth assumptions? Are there factors that you or we should be concerned about that have not yet been touched on? For example, there are some subject areas that we know we're deficient in terms of having an adequate number of teachers prepared to teach special ed, some of the other math, some of the other subject areas. How do these factors come together as we're looking at their application to the model and the reality of the model to a funding number?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record, James Sager with the Governor's Office. Senator Gordley, I think there are a number of pieces that you've kind of touched on. Mm-hmm. First of all, we have to think of the model as we're talking about it currently, where we're looking at what we refer to as the baseline model. We can only assume that the outcome of the performance level of our students is equal to what it currently is, and No Child Left Behind has the requirement that we improve the academic growth of students. So there's that component mixed into the whole scenario. We have, when we're looking at highly qualified teachers, as Mr. Reeder indicated, we are in better shape than nationally because we have had very high standards for our teaching force. where we're going to find ourselves in a little bit of a dilemma is at the middle school level, because we moved to the middle school model some years ago, where we started moving what we traditionally would view as elementary school teachers into the middle school area, because we could see the need for the transition for the students to have a smoother transition into the middle schools. Now, No Child Left Behind requires those middle school grade teachers to have a specialty area. And so we find ourselves a little bit in conflict there. We also find ourselves then in conflict at the high school level, where we have had to put teachers who are certified in one area teaching out of area in other subject areas to try and balance out the needs of the school with the personnel that they have. I think the other issue that ties back around when we're looking at staff and we're looking at the model, and again looking at the outcomes that we want for our students, is the growing need for ESL and special education staff that is adequately trained. So that's all the training issue. The retirement issue that we're facing right now is the fact that we are losing a very experienced workforce. So even though the new teachers coming out are well trained book-wise, they don't have that depth of experience and exposure to the needs of these students as the workforce that we're losing. And so we need to be very careful about not just assuming because we have a certified body in front of the students that we're going to be able to have the same result, because you're asking a brand new person to take on this responsibility from a person that had 20, 30 years of experience.
One of the things I'm hearing from you, Mr. Sager, then, is that we have some critical needs around professional development that suggests funding for professional development at the middle school level, the high school level, and particularly around ESL. So one of my questions still, Madam Chair, would be in looking at the baseline model growth assumptions, how are those needs, how and where are those needs taken into account in the model? I'm not clear that the model is touching those needs.
Mr. Reeder, do you have something to add to the discussion?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, the baseline model right now is based on sort of the level of resources and the types of activities that Oregon school districts were engaged in the 2001 school year. That's the latest detailed data we have to set the parameters in the model. To the extent that No Child Left Behind puts additional requirements on districts for professional development, then the baseline is not going to capture that.
One of the things we also know about the time since 2001 is that there's been a growth in the ESL population. So that would also need to be factored in. Is that correct?
Senator Gordley, that has been factored into the model. That growth has been already put in the model, yes.
Senator Gordley, if I might continue on your line of questioning,
please.
With the issue of needing to get everybody certified as a highly qualified teacher, my understanding is that there is funding available in the federal money that will contribute to some training issues. But what I'm really curious about here is, I recognize that that we're very much in transition on this, and that the teacher standards and practices people, in my understanding, are trying to get their arms around how to functionally accomplish what they need to accomplish, which is a lot in terms of the middle school teachers and the high school teachers, to get them certified in the areas that they'll be teaching in. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us, Mr. Sager, about how you see a rational way for the system to grapple with needing to get all these teachers tested. I mean, surely we can't shut the school system down and step through this. Or what's being talked about?
Chair Morgan, I'm not sure that anyone has come up with a rational way to deal with this, because you're right. It's not like an industry where we can shut down the assembly line for 30 days and retool and put it back online. In fact, we are going to have to look at bringing resources to bear on the current workforce to help make sure that they can meet the new standard of a highly qualified. I think even more important is the need for resources to now meet the higher academic standard that has been placed. So we as a state had committed to moving over the next several years, or at least in the model had committed to moving over the next several years to having 90% of our students meet standard. That would be if we were fully funding the quality education model. The federal government now, No Child Left Behind, has said we have to have that to 100%, and we have to have that by 2014. It seems to me that we now have a perfect opportunity to marry our standards and our trajectory with what the federal government is requiring. And so we have to look at what is the incremental increase that we have to attain with our student population to reach this goal. We have submitted that plan to the federal government. They have approved it. Now we have to say, if we're going to have this higher level of attainment, if we're going to have more and more students meet the standard, we have to have the resources to match that need. Currently, our resources give us an outcome that is, while it is good, and the results, as I shared with you on Thursday from the NAEP test and everything else, show that our children, based on kind of a national comparison, are doing quite well, they are not meeting the high standard that we have set here in Oregon, and we are not meeting it with all of our children. So as we look at implementing the model, while the baseline gives us this...
You're not answering the question that I asked you. What I was curious about was, given the fact that No Child Left Behind mandates that we have teachers certified as highly qualified teachers, and we have an issue that appears to be most acute in middle school, and then another issue that appears to be less acute but nonetheless an issue in high schools, mm-hmm. Talk to me about how rationally the system will deal with getting all those teachers certified. And the other question that I'm curious about is, given that we theoretically have been working with the training institutions on the teachers that are being put out into the marketplace, are those teachers competent in the areas that they're supposed to be teaching in when they come out of the training institutions, or does the system have to additionally train them?
Madam Chair, let me try to break it into the two components that you kind of laid out with looking at the current staff and how to make adjustments. There are a number of things that the school districts can do working with their staff. But first of all, we have to identify who those teachers are. So now we have to apply the new standard to the workforce to see where the disconnect is.
Well, isn't then we need to a mechanical issue for teachers to see whether they have the required level of certification in their degrees and in their files, and then bring their files up to date?
Chair Morgan, these rules just rolled out within about the last, I think it's about 30 days, and so I know that it is a step that has not been completed, and many of the teachers left the end of the school year not aware of whether or not that, you know, they needed additional training or whatever. So as we look into
standards and practices, have to have some kind of outreach scenario in place to get a hold of those teachers and let them know that there's an issue here.
Right. They're working with the individual school districts, who are also looking at what additional trainings have those staff members had that maybe TSPC doesn't even know about, because it would be within the district. So the district
phase is to just make sure that everyone's documentation reflects the actual situation.
Correct, Madam Chair. And then provide the training that those people need so that they can demonstrate that they have the competency to teach it at that class or that level.
So what is the training? The training is what teachers would ordinarily do over the summer? Is that how the training would normally take place?
Well, Madam Chair, on something as significant as this may be for some teachers, then my answer would be yes. The summertime is when about 85% of our workforce take classes of one sort or another, and if had they known what they needed, they could have, you know, tailored their summer program to meet that need. Instead, they're going to have to look at during the school year or next summer upgrading their training, their classes, or take the challenge tests that are available so that they can demonstrate that they have the knowledge base in order to meet the standard.
And what are challenge tests?
Well, there are practice tests, nationally recognized tests of knowledge level and pedagogy that teachers have to take as they hit certain intervals. Now, you can challenge taking a series of classes, for instance, by taking this test and demonstrating that, in fact, I have that knowledge base. I don't need to take the class to then take the test.
And is that like taking a SAT or something where you sit down on a Saturday and just work your way through it? What's functionally what happens when they take the test?
That would be a way to view it, yes.
So I would assume then that a certain number of them would feel that they had the competencies to be able to take the challenge test and come out the other side of it with the credential that they needed.
Madam Chair, I would think so also. Oftentimes, though, it's just not knowing what the test is going to be asking you compared to what you're teaching, and so there'll be a considerable amount of angst in the system about that.
Yeah, and I would imagine that there is. I know that if I was a teacher and this was happening to me and I was just learning right now that I should have done something 6 months ago, that there'd be a lot of frustration about how it unrolled.
Right.
But I know, one of the things I think that all of us have learned here is that the education community is very resourceful and resilient and hardworking folks. And so I'm sure that there will be things that are done here to have the least number of cases reflect that letter that go out to the parents. Especially when it's just a timing issue that prevents the teacher from getting the certification. So what I'm getting then is I see a kind of a triage approach where different solutions are going to apply to different teachers depending on the situation that they find themselves in.
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, we're going to have to tailor make the programs and the approaches to meet the needs of that staff.
And it would be, I think, safe to assume that there are going to be a certain percentage of teachers for whom timely solutions aren't going to be able to be found here.
Madam Chair, I think that timely solutions from the standpoint of beating the requirement for the first letter that's going out and people being caught off guard, correct.
That's what I was thinking.
You're right on point, though, when you stated that people will be very resourceful and look to every possibility to try and take care of that situation for the future.
Well, and I can imagine the frustration of a teacher that is competent to teach a subject and is doing a very good, credible job of teaching the subject area, but is caught up in this qualifying bureaucracy that prevents them from getting to where they need to be, and then to have this letter go out. And it would be, I think, kind of difficult personally to deal with that kind of an issue.
Madam Chair, it is rather demoralizing to think that you may have been teaching something 15, 20, 25 years and viewed as a very highly competent teacher, and then suddenly because of a change of definition find yourself now being identified as not being a highly qualified teacher.
Question. I'm sorry. What I'd like to do then is just briefly discuss the other part of my question, which is the beginning teachers that are coming out of the training facilities right now. How are they going to be positioned with in relation to being highly qualified, certifiable, highly qualified teachers?
Chair Morgan, as the school districts hire the new teachers, they can make sure that they are matching up their credentials with the placement that they're putting that teacher in. Again, as I mentioned, we went through a shift here in Oregon where we moved to what we call the middle school model, where we shifted a lot of our traditional grade school or elementary certified people to the middle schools because we saw the benefit to children. That doesn't match up now with the new requirement to have the subject-specific criteria. We moved to, for instance, social studies, language arts blocks for middle school students oftentimes having an elementary certified person teaching that block, it gave some time and transition. That no longer matches up correctly, and so we have to look at, on the experienced people, how we adjust that. On the new people, as they come in, we make sure that their certification now matches up with their assignment, and so we can adjust that. Where we face some challenges because of the new staff, as with any new person that comes into the workforce, you have a learning curve of now how to apply my academic knowledge into the workforce.
Then what I'm getting from you, and please correct me if I'm not getting the right impression here, that in terms of certifying teachers to be highly qualified teachers, the issue is going to be with the teachers that are already teaching, that the new teachers coming in will, if they're correctly placed in the area of expertise that they studied in, they should be okay. But the issue is in getting the documentation in order for a certain percentage of the existing workforce.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that statement.
Okay. Thank you. And, Senator Mosley had, but he's at Senator Gordley, follow-up.
I think Representative Smith was in the queue ahead of me.
Okay. This is a different line of questioning than the one you were working on?
Well, actually, it's this in the same vein of questioning.
But Representative Smith, please.
Thank you. Prior to No Child Left Behind, and I think it's still in existence, the national certifications teachers could get, okay? It was a higher level, thought to be a higher level. You needed greater skills to be able to get your national certification. Okay, how is that in line with No Child Left Behind?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, the National Teaching Standards Board has broken out the areas that you focus for your national certification so that it wouldn't be a disconnect with the No Child Left Behind requirement. Where the disconnect might be is that you would be nationally certified as a math teacher, for instance, but now find yourself teaching social studies or vice versa. So it would be your assignment that would be the disconnect. And so that's part of the issue that we're dealing with in schools, is to make sure that the workforce is matched up with the assignment to where they are properly certified.
So your national certification is subject area?
Correct. Okay. Or grade level area.
What is the national board doing as far, are they, if I am nationally certified to teach math, does that mean I am in compliance with No Child Left Behind in math?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I believe that that would be correct, yes, depending upon how the state has defined what their highly qualified teaching staff is, because it's both a national guideline, but then the states also have to establish what their criteria is.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A related question and concern would be, what are the schools of education doing to prepare for highly qualified teachers, and do those schools of education have adequate resources, meaning dollars and people with the right expertise or skill sets to help deliver the kind of qualified teachers that we need today? What is your take on those questions? And go ahead.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, I don't have enough information to go into much detail with you. I know that the schools of education are looking very carefully at this. They've been working very closely with TSPC to make sure that the training programs match up with our certification requirements. And as long then as the school districts hire and place those people in assignments that match up with the certification, I think over time we should have a good connection.
I would say, Madam Chair, that
yes.
Thank you. To have the most thorough examination of this particular issue, which is a very critical issue, we really need to have some additional partners in the room with us to help us have the conversation, and that would be our schools of education, public and private, because our private institutions, I believe, still turn out a majority of our teachers. And then we would also need to have, as a partner in the room, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Again, there are budgetary implications that are huge around professional development, long-standing issues not adequately addressed over time, and now we have this huge, huge challenge and accountability to the federal government, and not to mention the accountability standards that we've set for ourselves.
Mr. Reeder, just another technical question. Of the, and the question that I have relates to the 15% of teachers that are leaving that will be replaced by teachers that are much lower on the experience scale. The of the 15% that are retiring, I would imagine, what I'm curious about is you're saying that there's a bubble going through of people that are in that age group that are eligible to, for retirement. Is there any way that you can give us an idea of that bubble of people that are our most experienced teachers? How much of, what percentage of that group is retiring?
Chair Morgan, I believe from the data we have that we can answer that question. I can't answer it right now, but the data we have has in for individual teachers has their years of experience, their the subject area that they teach, their age, and so forth. So I think we can probably answer that question.
And where I'm trying to get to is of the 85% of the teachers that are still going to be in the system, the trying to use the numbers to quantify whether there is a suitable base of teachers there experience-wise to mentor the incoming teachers.
Chair Morgan, I'm not sure that I can answer that question, but certainly we can make the data available to those who can.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Bates?
Yes, Madam Chair. I had a couple questions along the lines that we were talking about as far as No Child Left Behind. Can I ask three or four questions quickly? When do you expect these letters to go out, and do you know how many letters we're going to be sending out about teachers not being highly qualified?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, I'm sorry, I don't recall the date which the school districts have to send those out. It's coming up soon. The problem with telling you how many is the fact that, as I indicated, we are just now going through the process of actually matching up the new requirements with each individual teacher's certification, their additional training, and their assignment. And so that that process is underway.
Follow up.
I'm going to draw on my limited experience as a school board member for 10 years with a moderate-sized school district, not one of the biggest, not one of the smallest. We had about 5,000 or 6,000 kids. We commonly had to place teachers in certain times in teaching positions they weren't necessarily highly qualified for because we had no other choice. We didn't have enough staff to commonly, you know, hit every class exactly. Now, these people were quite capable of teaching the courses, but they may not have been, as I'd say, buffed up their curriculum to make it look like their, you know, paper that was the best of all worlds. And many of these, the districts of that size are going to have those kind of problems. I could foresee in our district half the teachers would have a letter going out without much trouble. And the impression that might give the public could be rather devastating. And as an individual teacher, if I was caught in that position, I don't think I'd be demoralized. I think I'd be very angry. I think anger is the word I would use for it. After all the years of teaching and being competent and being well-respected in your community, to have a letter go out of that nature would be questionable. The question that leads to for me is, what are we doing as far as allowing them to get that education? Teachers are busy during the year. They don't have time to go and take classes. The teachers are working all day in the classrooms and commonly evenings and weekends preparing for the next week. When summertime comes, not everybody lives in Eugene or Portland. They have to travel and live somewhere for 6 to 8 weeks to get their education if those courses they need are even available. Is there any attempt for long-distance learning for these people, online learning for them, courses they can take online that would get them to be in a situation where they'd be considered highly qualified? What's happening? You guys have got a big job to do very quickly to get that done. But is anything happening to take care of this? And what are those letters going to look like? Have you actually seen copies of the letter that's going to be sent out?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, I have not seen a copy of the letter. I simply know the material that has to be in it and the identification of the school and the staff members that are not now defined as highly qualified. I don't know if Ozzie sitting behind me has seen any of those letters or not, but you're absolutely correct. It would be demoralizing, would make you angry, very frustrating to suddenly be labeled this way. As far as gearing up and looking at distance learning opportunities, a number of our public and private universities have created online distance learning programs for people. Again, it's a time factor, and you're absolutely right. I think you may have been out of the room when I mentioned this earlier, but because of the time frame, many of our staff members are going to have to either try to squeeze things in during this next school year or wait until next summer to be able to put a plan together to meet this requirement. And in the meantime, they will have been labeled as not highly qualified.
I'm going to ask Mr. Burke from the department to come forward and see if you can outline some of these issues. I really do share Representative Bates' concern here about how we're whiplashing good teachers, and this doesn't seem very fair to me.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Pat Burke, Deputy Superintendent for Education Policy. Which of the questions, Madam Chair, would you like me to address first?
Well, start with the ones that Representative Bates was asking, which is, I believe, if I might be so presumptuous as to recap, is functionally, how are we going to deal with good teachers having these letters going out saying that they aren't really good teachers?
Correct. Let's put this, Madam Chair, into a sequence. The first part of the sequence in Oregon is that the board, under state law, has the responsibility for defining licensure and certification, had to reach agreement on what the definition was. And that was a complex process. It took almost a year because you have got to go back to pre-1965 and look at all of the different definitions of teacher certification that are in place in our schools now and determine if all of those definitions meet the qualifications of the law. That took a considerable amount of time for the TSPC board. They finally reached agreement in their April meeting the next day, but we were ready to go as soon as TSPC reached their definitions. We issued a survey to school districts to begin the process of collecting the data. Apply the definition, collect the data. It's the local school district's responsibility to determine if their teachers meet these qualifications. Now, the difference here is that this now goes down to the class level, which is a change in how we collect the data. It had been collected at the school level. Now it's collected on a class-by-class basis, teacher-by-teacher basis. Districts have until August 15th to submit their data. That will then give us a box to know where we are in this process. TSPC is also currently in negotiations with the U.S. Department of Education on the middle school issue. And the middle school issue is complicated, as Mr. Sager has pointed out, depending on when the teacher was certified and whether or not, for example, their elementary certification, which did require them to document knowledge in the core areas of English, math, science, and social science to get an elementary certificate. TSPC is trying to work with the U.S. Department of Education to verify that that level of preparation was adequate to meet the terms of subject matter competence that is required in No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind does not specifically require a subject matter endorsement. It requires hours or a minor or a major in a subject matter. So the issue right now is whether or not the conditions of elementary certification during that window could meet those requirements. If it does, there's about a 10-year window of teachers that would be considered highly qualified under the new law. So we're very excited about that. That's a recent development and is currently in negotiation. So then after you have an idea of who is and who is not meeting this particular standard, the federal law requires the local district for Title I schools that receive Title I funds, for the parents to be notified within 30 days of the opening of school that they have the right to request information from the school district on the qualifications of the teacher. And the qualifications of the teacher are defined as their years of experience, degrees held, and certification in the state. For example, it's not allowed to request the personnel file of the teacher or transcript information or other things that are considered confidential information. Within 4 weeks, four consecutive weeks of any teacher teaching a course for which they are not highly qualified, only the parents of the students in that course must be notified that the teacher is not highly qualified and that they have the right to request information on the professional preparation of the teacher. So what we have, and one additional point, new hires in Title I schools must meet these conditions now for both teacher certification and for paraprofessional certification. So school districts beginning with this school year, actually it began last school year, for schools that received Title I funds had to meet these requirements. Now, what happens Representative Bates' question about the letter. There will be, in effect, two types of letters. One is a general letter notifying parents that they may request information on the professional qualifications of the staff, and the school district is obligated under the law to have that information available and to provide it upon request. Second type of letter will be parents who are in a classroom for two parents of students who are in a classroom for four consecutive weeks. This is going to particularly be a problem in small and rural high schools and middle schools where there are multiple certificates. There's a front page article in the New York Times this morning, and you may have seen the article in the Oregonian yesterday about this issue. It's a particular problem where you've made the distinction earlier, Madam Chair, between competence and certification, and that is a very important distinction. Let me parenthetically say that all Oregon teachers are appropriately certified. So the issue is whether or not they are assigned in an assignment that matches their certification. But we and our standards, as was pointed out in the Oregonian yesterday, are actually quite high compared to others. The second point about that is that teachers coming out of our institutions now, the schools of education now, our teachers already possess a subject matter degree, and they have already passed a test in their subject matter. That's part of Oregon certification. So in terms of the new standards, new hires coming out of Oregon institutions already meet these qualifications. So then the issue is assignment. Are people appropriately assigned? Now, as to the four-week letter, that will be more difficult. That will be specific to the teacher and the parents. It applies specifically to Title I schools. Parents would be notified that the teacher is not highly qualified for the assignment. There are two ways to think about the consequences as a result of that. Once districts have their data on August 15th, they also have control over 95% of the federal Title II dollars that come to the state. That's about $25 million. It's allocated to districts on a per capita basis, and the school districts may use that money to address the certification of their teachers. They can use those funds to provide access to workshops and credit-bearing courses and other ways for teachers to increase their content knowledge if they are not highly qualified. The second area is the districts are required to submit a plan to us identifying what they are going to do to reduce the number of teachers who are not highly qualified. And then we are also required to submit to the U.S. Department of Education our own plan, what we would do to reduce the number of teachers who are not highly qualified. So at each level of the system, there are both resources and accountability structures to try to increase the number of teachers who meet these requirements.
Thank you. That was very informative. Do you have follow-up questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. The problem I see it is several ones. First, the assignment problem is going to be huge.
Yes.
You're going to have highly qualified teachers. You'll need certain courses covered, and you won't have personnel for it, or you put them in that position, and then parents get the letter, which leads parents to believe that they haven't got a qualified teacher teaching a course, which probably isn't true, because the districts will make good decisions as they go along with what resources they have available as far as personnel is concerned. That's one problem, and a big one, especially for districts of medium and small size. Although I would tell you, I would bet even in the big districts it's going to be a problem get to site to site. What it leads you towards is huge high schools instead of smaller high schools, because that's the only way you can make these assignments work. And I have some questions about the size of our schools already, when you know the studies show that smaller schools produce better effect, regardless of what you're talking about as far as highly qualified teachers. The second thing is timing. How in the world can you expect districts and teachers to respond to something that's going to be decided August 15th and be implemented a month later? That is ridiculous. Totally ridiculous. And not fair to teachers, not fair to districts, and not fair to students and parents. I assume there's some negotiation going on between the feds and the state, and I would hope that part of that discussion is give us at least a year to make these things change. I can't believe people just roll over for this. What's been the sense of discussion between the state of Oregon and the federal government? We faced this in Medicaid problems and had some knockdown fights about it, but usually came up with something that would work. So what's going on here as far as that negotiation is concerned? Are we just taking on the chin? What's happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, first of all, I am not an apologist for the U.S. Department of Education. I think some of the things that you've identified are true and are going to be problems. Once it hits the front page of the New York Times, for example, that's one indication to us that this is reaching a level of national debate that's pretty serious in this issue of highly qualified teachers. Having said that, however, let me point out a couple of things. The law requires that this be addressed by the end of the 2006 school year, so we have some time for teachers to become aware that they may need to address areas of certification. And there are a growing number, as Mr. Sager pointed out, there are a variety of ways that are being identified for teachers to do this. One very exciting one is an online reading endorsement that the schools of education have come together on. It's called Read Oregon, and it's a way for all of the schools of education to have come together on the qualifications for reading endorsement for certification, and sharing resources and providing online access. It's a very exciting development. I think we can do more of that. However, in terms of our negotiations with the U.S. Department, as I've mentioned, TSPC met with Ms. Chamberlain last Friday. She is excited about what appears to be some positive signals from the U.S. Department to listen to how we have certified teachers in the past. We feel that we have had rigorous qualifications to become a teacher in Oregon, and we think there will be some flexibility in those definitions. In terms of the public, we have a regular meeting of major partners, COSA, OSEA, OEA, OSBA, and the department, to identify the public relations and communications issues that are facing us as we roll this out. And one of the critical ones is obviously whether or not we can communicate to our public that teachers in Oregon do meet rigorous standards of qualification, and that what we have here is a technical issue of whether or not they possess the coursework or content knowledge in a particular area of assignment, so that someone with a PhD in mathematics, for example, in a high school teaching four sections of math is extremely qualified, in fact, overqualified for the position in terms of the federal law, but might also be a very competent teacher of a section of physics, which is essentially a mathematics-based discipline, and could be a very effective physics teacher with very high qualifications, but according to this definition of the law, does not meet those qualifications because he does not have certification in physics. So that may be an area where some of the Title II money that is available or the ongoing professional development or what are called CPDs or continuing professional development units that the teacher is required to earn as part of their license or the renewal of their license, that teacher would have a plan to concentrate in the area of physics as he or she went on in their teaching assignment. In other words, I believe there are ways to communicate this that show that teachers are committed to ongoing professional development and that there is a plan for that professional development to be related to their assignment and not necessarily communicate that this is a non-qualified teacher or someone who is doing a bad job in the classroom. Because in many of these cases, these are, especially in rural and small districts, these are teachers that are highly regarded in their communities. They've been there for years and do an excellent job. On the other hand, and I think we have to look at this both ways, this gives us a very important tool. There are teachers who could be identified that really don't have the content knowledge. The underlying assumption in the law, I believe, is very clear and appropriate, that a teacher teaching content knowledge should be well prepared in that content knowledge to deliver the instruction. So this is also a tool for local school districts to look at their assignment of their workforce and the degree of preparation of the workforce and to make important decisions about whether or not we have the best teachers where they are needed the most. And then give them the flexibility in their Title II dollars to target their professional development to make improvements where they are identified. And that's the underlying philosophy behind the law. And the first step of that is we've got to have solid data on who the teachers are, where they're assigned, and what the level of preparation is.
Well, and I don't think, Mr. Burke, that there would be a lot of disagreement with the underlying assumptions in that we should have highly qualified teachers teaching the areas that they're teaching in. I think what is objectionable here is that we're caught in an implementation time frame that is going to catch some teachers that are very competent in the crossfire and set them up in their communities as being incompetent when that isn't, in fact, the reality. And it's only because there isn't enough time built into the process to allow the certification process to catch up with the demands of being certified or the demands of No Child Left Behind.
Madam Chair, I agree with your analysis. I think in this first year especially, there will be confusion in the public, and that's one of the reasons that we've come together as a communications team to try to do the best we can to allay those fears. I think the important thing to continue to stress, and actually the Oregonian highlighted this in its article yesterday, is that Oregon standards in terms of states in the West are actually among the highest. And that one of the things that TSPC could have done, but clearly decided not to do, is lower those standards. We have maintained high standards for teacher quality in the state. That is going to put us in somewhat of an awkward position because of those standards. We may end up identifying teachers that don't meet them in some areas. But then the solution is, how can we address that in the professional development of our staff rather than lower our standards? And Oregon staked out the high ground, and I think we did it appropriately.
Follow up?
Well, Madam Chair, you say you put yourself in an awkward position. Actually, you haven't. You put some teachers in an awkward position, quite bluntly.
A good point.
You're not going to be having a letter go out to your parents about you, okay? How long has Teacher Standards and Practices known about the requirement for the second letter?
Well, the requirement is in the law. The law was passed in January of 2002. So, and TSPC as a board has been studying the issue for about Well, beginning, and it was before I came to the agency, I think they started last spring. The department had a workforce around highly qualified teachers that met all of last year. So I'm saying probably 10 months that TSPC board was working through the analysis of the current licensure requirements. And all of that is around the requirement to notify. You have to identify the number of teachers to notify.
I share the chair's position on this. I think this is grossly unfair to teachers. I think it's going to cause problems, more than just a public relations problem. And many parts of the states could be very difficult. Not everybody even reads the Oregonian. Okay, I know it's hard to believe up here, but down there we get the San Francisco paper and the Mail Tribune. Thank you. We like to get our news up to date and straight once in a while.
We don't get either of those in Roseville.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, that's not the whole state, okay? Yeah. Or the Oregonian just doesn't cover the whole state. And even if they did, not everybody reads that paper. I'm very concerned about this. Maybe I'm overreacting on this, and if I do, I apologize. But I have many friends who are teachers. I can imagine how they're going to feel if a letter like that goes out to their students next fall sometime. They're going to be enraged, and I think rightfully so. I would ask you if you can get the federal government to give you a year on this to do it. And if it means lowering standards temporarily to avoid those letters, I would do it. Give the teachers a year to prepare and get ready to make sure they're qualified for their assignments as best they can. Because I think this is more than a public relations problem. I think this is a real shot to the schools at a time when people are questioning how well our schools are functioning.
Well, I think Representative Bates said it does require some great thought in a solution, because one of the things that we're seeing is, I think, a lack of understanding on the part of the public about what is going on in the schools, and that it's translating to a lot of problems that districts are having, getting levies passed and things like that. And I would hate for these letters, because of a timing issue, to be putting more fuel on that fire, and people being able to use that to say that the education system isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, when in reality there it just is an issue of implementing federal regulation and the timing around the state being able to deal with it. So I think that there does need to be a great deal of thought put into this from the point of view of how the public is going to perceive the K to 12 system if these letters go out about teachers that truly are competent teachers. So, and I recognize the complexity that you have, where you're trying to balance our federal partners on one hand in that very important revenue stream with the needs to keep our systems in the state functioning and have a level of integrity to them too. But I agree with Representative Bates that the timing issues around the federal implementation push are going to cause us a huge amount of problem.
Madam Chair, I do agree with that. Let me respond a little bit of what's been going on in the state. Our agency has now completed three regional rounds in the state. We started a year ago last spring with our Title I regional conferences. Last fall and early winter, we did a second round through in collaboration with COSA in workshops all around the state, spending 2 days with superintendents in particular on these issues. And then our Title I staff has just completed this spring its second round of regional workshops. OSBA has had this as a major part of their state conference this past winter, and OEA has addressed it with its staff. This is an issue that is getting a lot of attention. Secondly, the letters themselves, especially to the Title I schools, the letters say that teachers or that parents have the right to request information on the professional qualifications of teachers teaching their children, and that the district has a responsibility to provide that information. That's what's required in the letter, not necessarily saying to parents that the teachers who teach in the school are bad teachers. And there are a variety of ways that that can be done, where a letter that introduces the staff, for example, and talks about the years of experience or how long a teacher has been at that school or what their professional background is would be a very positive or proactive way of introducing the staff to the community and providing the information and letting parents know that they have the right to request.
Well, and I don't think that's the problematic letter. I think it's the second letter that's going to cause the problem.
Correct. And the second letter is specifically directed only to the parents of children that are being taught by that particular teacher. So there is an area where I am concerned because there is a shortage in this area, and it is going to be a problem. For a teacher, for example, who goes on maternity leave or has an extended family illness or for some reason is absent for 4 consecutive weeks or longer and is replaced by a substitute, if that substitute does not have the credentials, say I've got a substitute who comes in and takes over a science class, or is teaching in a middle school in a math class without certification in mathematics, then the district is supposed to notify after 4 weeks that that teacher is not highly qualified for that position. Those letters are not system-wide. They are specifically to the parents of kids in that classroom. And I certainly agree with Representative Bates. This is an area where there is a great opportunity for misunderstanding, and there will be teachers that find these letters very difficult. We're trying to work with OEA and COSA and OSBA to strike the right communication balance of both accountability and fairness to our workforce.
I kind of take what you said and put it in the context of my legislative district. And in my legislative district, really what it is small towns that are less than 4,000 people that are around a school.
Yeah.
And people talk to each other a lot. And what goes on in the schools is a huge piece of what the communities are all about.
Yeah.
And what really is frightening to me here is the potential to ruin a good teacher's reputation because this information goes out and the word goes out in the community that everybody's getting letters that this person isn't a qualified teacher. And trying to deal with that, I think, is it's not fair to the teachers.
I have this personal feeling, just an observation. We have said, I've said before this committee and have certainly heard others say it as well, there are some fundamental flaws in this legislation. And some of those flaws I don't think are going to be addressed until legislation comes up for reauthorization. We have continuously heard from the U.S. Department and from our legislative delegation that there will be no consideration of amendments. Now, we are working in collaboration with the National Education Association that has introduced 42 of what they call adjustments. Frankly, the use of amendment is dead on arrival with Congress. What we are proposing, or what NEA is proposing, is that there be some consideration to adjustments to the legislation. The Chief State School Officers Association and the American Association of School Administrators, those are the three kind of major players here, have all indicated an interest in wanting to talk with Congress about adjustments to the legislation. There are a variety of areas, not the least of which are the rural issues, where not only for teacher quality, but for adequate yearly progress and offering choice. If I have to bus kids 100 miles each way to offer them a choice of another school, it seems counterproductive and, in fact, would do harm to children. Then there are issues like that that need to be addressed. The legislation comes up for reauthorization 4 years from now, there are clearly some areas that are going to have to be addressed then. But we do hope that some adjustments to the legislation can be made to avoid some of these problems.
Committee members, we have gotten into it. This has been a fascinating discussion, but it unfortunately is pretty far from our scenario discussions that we're supposed to be having here. So what I'd like to do, if nobody has any burning issues to be raised, is to allow Ms. McGlashan to continue to step us through these scenarios here so we can be done on time. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think that the committee learned a great deal about how highly qualified teachers is going to be rolled in to the K to 12 system. Ms. McGlashan.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I think we were still on the first scenario where it does not include funding for COLAs and STEPs or services and supplies and inflation. And I had directed your attention to that second page so that you could see the growth rates that were input into this scenario. So if nobody has any further questions on this one, I'll just move on to the next one.
Questions?
These pages are not. I must get my mind back on this. These pages are not numbered, and so I'm having a little trouble going back and forth between them.
Representative Bates, this is the policy scenario where up in the upper left-hand corner on the first page it says zero salary growth.
Does that mean in that one there's no inflation?
Yeah,
that's correct.
No. So if we were to put a one above the first column and a one on the top of this page, we would have it.
There you go.
Okay.
Which is what I did.
All right.
Then in the second impact analysis form, this is one where all the input factors are the same. In other words, COLAs and STEPs and S&S inflation are not funded, but in this scenario, they're assumed to be incurred. And this is mainly because you've heard that districts are in the process of contracting or have contracts in effect that will affect all are part of the 0305 biennium, that probably some inflation cannot be avoided. So if you look at the policy scenario column, you'll see that it's about the same as the other amount, about $4.82 billion. And the way that you arrive at the impact of not funding these, but assuming that they're incurred, is then if you look at the attachment behind there, it says model assumptions on the upper in the upper left-hand corner, and you look at the policy scenario assumptions column again, and it's shaded for you, and turn to the second page, about the middle of the page, it says length of school years, and this is for illustrative purposes only. You could have changed any one of a number of things in this policy scenarios or policy scenario assumptions column. What I did is I started reducing the number of days until I got to the $4.8 billion level. Is everybody following me? In other words, you can manipulate, if you will, this policy scenario assumptions column, the input factors, and it'll drive the total funding in the policy scenario column on the front page down to whatever level you want.
So you just started by putting like 189 in the days and worked your way down until you hit the 4.8 level.
Right. So that's just an example of at that funding level, if that's the actual funding level, but if you assume that the districts still are going to incur certain costs, what it will do in terms of, in this example, number of days. You could have increased class size, cut staffing, any one of a number of things in the in that column.
When you assumed that they would, the S&S inflation category, they were not funded, but did you base the assumption on all of the categories would be spent at the full inflation level?
Madam Chair, what I did was, and maybe it will help if you look at the next quality education model impact analysis policy scenario, QEM baseline with PERS at 11.11%, health benefits growth at 9%, and revised salary forecasts and inflation rates. If you look at that one, and you see in the policy scenario column the $5.139 billion, that's the one I started with. And then I just went in and reduced the number of days till the funding actually got to the 4.9.
So you do have the full roll-up in all of the line items for S&S increases.
Right. If you turn to that second page, you'll see what all those assumptions are for that 5.139.
5.1 is 190 days?
Senator Gordley, correct.
Does anybody have any questions about what they're seeing here and what went into the assumptions?
Okay. This sheet can reflect all three of these, right? I made a huge leap here by saying that.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, in this case, the model assumption sheet here goes with the second scenario.
Okay, got it.
Which is no salary increases or inflation funded, but the districts do incur the costs.
So, members, if I might be so presumptuous to push you through this, if you put a 2 above the second column,
mm-hmm.
and then put a 2 on the impact analysis that says no salary increases or inflation funded, but districts incur costs, loss of 11 school days.
Got it. That's number 2.
And then put a 2 on the model assumptions.
Got it.
And then put a 3 above the last column.
Right.
And put a 3 on the impact analysis that says policy scenario, QEM baseline with PERS at 11.11, health benefits growth at 9, revised salary forecasting inflation rates created 6.1903.
Got it.
Then I think all of the displays will add up to this summary sheet.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, thank you for that. And thank staff for trying to lay some foundation for what we're trying to do. I would like to discuss a couple of the assumptions just real quickly, though.
Can we add one more piece before you do that? Because there's one more model, the impact analysis, that was done as a result of the conversations in the leadership meeting. Ms. McGlash.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, and this is not on that summary sheet before you, but there was a question asked, what would the full model implementation look like with the lower PERS rate of 11.11%, because the original one was built on, I believe, 18%, and the revised salary forecast, and also some decreases in the implicit price deflator, because those have also gone down. And so I ran that scenario simply by, with the policy scenario, just put in all the assumptions under the full model, and that gets you to about $6.5 billion. And the original version was, I believe, $6.9 billion. It's down several $100 million, primarily as a result of the PERS.
And that's also health benefits static at 9.
Right.
Revised salary for and inflation.
Right.
What rate of inflation? 1.37.
It's, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, it's the same. The same growth rates under the $5.14 billion.
Got it. As is in this one.
Well, the only difference would be that instead of using the baseline model assumptions, which all the other analysis use, mm-hmm. this particular one would use the full model mm-hmm. assumptions.
Got it.
Questions?
I'm trying to frame a question here. I'm wondering, and perhaps Ozzie Rose can help us with this piece. We had the recent survey of districts and their responses telling us what level of funding would be adequate to meet the needs of the school year. And the ranges were, I think, 4.9 to 5.6. Actually, they went above 5.6. As I recall, there were only 2 districts that said they could function at the 4.9 level. And now obviously, we don't know what assumptions any of the districts used in arriving at their numbers, but Ozzie, I'm wondering, can you help us at this juncture by giving us a perspective and some context? We have the model in front of us and variations on the model. And then we have this other reality of all the districts that responded saying this is the number that a given district can live with.
Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And before, Ms. Rose, first of all, we have some information that talks about what the districts assumed for their PERS rates when they wrote their budgets, which may be instructive to the committee members, too. So I would ask Ms. McGlashan to talk to us a little bit about that. And while she's handing that out, I'd just like to say that before we met today, Mr. Rose came before us and said that he had already made his last public speech in his official capacity. So if you would come back up here, Mr. Rose, please, at the chair's request. I would just like to say that there is going to be a big hole in the force around the building when you finally walk out of here, and that we do so much appreciate the information that you share with all the members of the legislative process because of your knowledge and your history in what's unfolded here for so many years. And it is with great pleasure that we have you here today in one of your unanticipated public speeches, and we very much look forward to hearing what you have to say on this. And this, let me have Ms. McGlashan talk about what this is and where it came from.
Great.
Madam Chair, am I supposed to go now or after?
After.
Okay.
Madam Chair, my understanding is this came from the Speaker's office. Staff in her office did some phoning around to various school districts and talked to the contacts that you see listed on this sheet to get information, I think primarily about what their existing PERS rate is and then what they're assuming for their 0305 budget. So this might help shed a little light on why there's such a variation in the funding amounts.
And I would ask the committee members, I mean, this has come out of the Speaker's office, mm-hmm. and you do have the contact information for where the numbers were gotten from. So this is not a document that came out of LFO. The Ms. McGlashan, for every change, every percentage change in the PERS rate, what's the impact?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, and this is a rough rule of thumb because it does depend on which base you start with, but roughly for every percentage point change in PERS, it's about $50 million in this budget.
$50 million. So it has a huge impact, and the driver for that is the 85% or more of each individual budget that goes towards payroll costs. Mr. Rose.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. To the first question of the difference between we're looking at the model and looking at the data that we gathered, we are still in the process of taking a locally funded school system and turning it into a state-funded school system, and each district's got 100 years of history of decisions. I used to describe it as taking a blanket and throwing it over a large prairie full of holes with prairie dogs in them, and every time one comes up, you hit it there, another one comes up somewhere else. So you still have that process and that problem. The model speaks to the state as a whole and a large sum of money and how it should work. The assumptions we asked for, what we told the folks, what do you need to do to replace this school year, 2003, not the 2002 school year, which we made. There were three series of cuts related to special sessions before they adopted the budget for 2003. And we just asked, what would it take to restore this year's school year? And I did it in part because restoring the school year seemed to be we'll get the same number of school days, and I don't believe a school year is the number of school days. It's a set of programs and service. So that was my objective. And so essentially and I told them how to compute what 4.9495 would do. And so they would have taken that information and said, okay, I've got this set of teachers. I've cut these many. I want to add them back. I've had these programs. I've cut them. I want to add them back. I've got a collective bargaining agreement that says this. They would live by their current. And I had advised them that I believe the PERS rate would come in around 13, 13.5. That was the best information I've been able to get until last week from the PERS staff. Everybody's a little conservative, as you know, trying to guess that stuff. And I was pretty impressed. You asked 10 districts, I was figured in, five of them came close to taking my advice, so that's pretty cool. And one of them, by the way, Salem, they're still using their, on this number, 1858, but at their last budget meeting, they adopted a budget assuming it would drop to 13 and said, we'll take, if it doesn't, we'll take the money out of a contingency. So the budget they're actually adopted isn't anticipating 18, it's anticipating around the 13. But I would guess this is probably not inaccurate, people, until the last week. Nothing's in writing on the PERS thing and all that stuff, so I would guess. And so this, the numbers our people gave us, probably half of them were in the 13 range. The other half were still at 16, or some I know had dropped to 16 earlier. And so, yes, there will be some extra or differences there that would be in addition to what we told you.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordy.
How should we look at districts that are challenged by really dramatic changes in their demographics, increasing numbers of ESL students, the special ed population? How should we be considering those needs, those factors, as we look at the model and the assumptions?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, I think for you, it's very difficult to do that very accurately because, again, it's district by district. And the information that I give, I thought the range, I was a little surprised at the range of what they said to restore this school year. I believe you're correct. There were three of them that could do it under $5 billion, and it went up all the way to $6 billion. But the bulk of the folks were in the $3 to $5.6 billion mm-hmm. range, I think. And, again, they would have reflected the other part of it is people begin cutting. Some cut earlier, some cut later. What I asked for was, can we restore this school year? And it wasn't our top school year. It was the one that reflected, I'd say, after your third session. Now, some districts addressing that need would be in that discussion. Some it wouldn't be. And I don't know how to pin that down any tighter. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to say this part. The response that I get to that was the pragmatic approach. What do I have to do to make my school district work in Burns next year? And it wasn't highly sophisticated and so forth, but I think that you can depend on it as being accurate.
Mm-hmm.
That what do I have to do to restore my athletic program, any special ed, or what I've cut this year to make my school district next year the same as it was this year? That's all we ask. And I was with quite a number of them the last 2 days of the last week, and I think it's pretty good information. It differs from this for the very specific reason that
Mr. Rose, the other piece that has been very interesting for us to try to get our arms around is the issue of the experienced teachers retiring and the lower paid beginner teachers coming in and the differential that's involved there in the salary payments. And again, because salary is a huge factor, you can get little changes in anything to do with salary, and it has big impacts on the bottom line. When the districts were building their budgets, was that an issue that was factored into the discussions?
Madam Chair, every year that is in the budget. When you build a budget, the budget's a big deal. It's a planning document. And for Salem, it's 100 or 50 million, whatever the number is. And when you build the budget, you make assumptions that assume I'm going to lose so many at the high and move in some. That's an every-year process. I am confident that in building this year's budget, they'd already had notices. I mean, we had a ton of notices this spring, and they're still coming in as the paper changed the story, that, yes, that would be part of the budget-making process. You know, look, we think this is going to happen, and you make some assumptions.
Is there anywhere I don't know who has the information or if indeed it's in any one place where we can get the information about what the PERS rate was that districts built their budget on and what the health care increase costs were that they built their budgets on and then how they dealt with the turnover, the retirement and replacement issue? Does that reside in one place?
It does not reside in one place. I had intended to this morning sent out an email to our folks, tell them the 1111 was real and they could count on it. And if you're interested, I can probably get half or more of the districts respond within 24 hours of what assumption they were using, and does this make a difference if that. But again, it's those that respond rather than, I think the list you saw of the districts and the other, I think we had about 80 districts out of the 198, so but I can get that in a 24-hour period if you think that would be helpful to you.
But one of the things that has been both interesting and frustrating to me as we've tried to kind of go through these issues of coming up with a platform to discuss the state school fund under is there is some really interesting chunks of data that are available through the Data Initiative Project, but there's also a bunch of holes, and one of the big holes is what the actual negotiated contracts are between the districts and the employees, and what's involved in terms of salaries and benefits and the early retirement issues and all of the other issues that have a big impact on the budget. I think that one of the things from my point of view that would make it a lot easier for us to do our job in terms of projecting where we are going to be in needs for funding and resources in the future is to have that information available to policymakers. And so, I don't know if this is even a question, but I do see that as one of the data needs that isn't being filled right now.
Madam Chair, that's a problem created by your predecessors when they dedicated to local school boards the authority to run school districts. But yes, we can probably get data better than we have currently. The one thing I think is interesting about this morning's discussion and the survey we did, if you go to the assumption that you're not going to cut school days, you wind up with $5.1 billion. Mm-hmm. And if you go to what we put out and said, what do you have to do to restore a regular school year for next year? Most of our answers were in the 5.35 range, so it's in the same kind of ballpark. I think that's instructive, especially because some of ours also would still be using the higher PERS rate. So I think there's give you some confidence that we're kind of shooting in the same area and have relatively good data without
Senator
precise
Madam
data.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize if my questions have been answered while I was in absence. Maybe you can talk to me after. But I have two basic questions I was going to ask before I left. Number one is that as we talk about retirees and filling those positions with less experienced personnel, a lot of those positions simply aren't going to be filled with our downturn in the economy as well as our reduction of enrollments in many districts. So we've got our arms around what numbers we're talking about there. Of those retiring, how many of those positions? Maybe this is a question for Mr. Reeder as well, but it seems to me that that's an area that I don't understand, at least, or don't have a sense of what that would mean.
Mr. Reeder, can you give us any insight on this?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, when we try to forecast teacher salaries, one of the things that we really need to know is how many total teachers that districts will have in a given year, and that depends on a couple of things. First of all, how many students they'll have, but also how much funding they'll have. So in a real sense, we won't know how many teachers that districts can replace until we know how much money they're going to have to spend, and that really is a function of the state school fund. So we have a sort of a simultaneous thing going on here that we don't really know how much we're going to spend on teachers until we know what the state school fund number is going to be.
Chair, if I might ask another question, and maybe you've covered this one as well. When we talk about school days, when I think of school days, I think of contact time with students. And yet I see a note in this one footnote that we're talking about holidays and in-service days and all of that. Can we break that down, or is that tied into contracts and there's nothing that can change there? If we're, when we reduce school days, are we actually talking about contact time with students?
Chair Morgan, Senator Mesnily, in the quality education model, we put in what we call contract days, which is the number of days that teachers are contracted to work, and that typically is excuse me, around 190 days per year, and of those 190 days, right around 175 would be days in contact with students. In order to achieve savings, it's possible to reduce the number of days that teachers work without reducing the number of days they actually have contact with students. But again, that's a contract issue. So when in the model, when we reduce the number of days, it could be reducing the number of days teachers are actually teaching students, or it could be some other day that where they, you know, they could give up a teacher training day, or they could give up something else, but that's a contract issue.
Mr. Reeder, if there's 175 contact days with the students, is there 7 paid holidays standard to each district?
Chair Morgan, I don't know the details of most contracts. Maybe Ozzie has a better sense for that than I do.
Okay. Mr. Sager is shaking his head up and down in the affirmative and counting on his fingers right now.
Are you highly qualified for that position?
Yeah. Chair Morgan, yes, it is standard within about 9 different days, because some of the school districts, for instance, have Martin Luther King as a non-work, non-paid day. Others recognize that as one of the 7 paid holidays. But within the framework of the year, there are about, out of 9 or 10 days, 7 of those are designated as the paid holidays: Labor Day, Memorial Day, Christmas, New Year's, etc.
So then the leftover 8 days are the training and in-service days.
Typically, the school districts will have 2 to 3 days at the beginning of the school year, 2 to 3 at the end of the school year, 1 at the end of each grading period.
Okay, thank you. Senator Mesnily, did I cut you off on your questions?
No, I think we're getting there.
Okay. We are actually 2 minutes from the end of the time that we have available, so what I think we better do is quit talking here. And what I'll do is adjourn the committee meeting and notify the members that we'll be reconvening at 8:30 tomorrow morning to do the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget.